We have an SOS announcement, meaning saving our seats. If anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all traditions, let's make saving our seats a spiritual foundation too. If you arrive early, please just save a seat for yourself and one other. Exceptions would be a seat saved due to a service commitment. If someone sits in your usual seat before you get there, be kind and let it go. First come, first seat. 5 minutes before the meeting begins, any saved seat not occupied should be relinquished. Thank you. My name is Harry, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would be also helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature person, Dustina and Kobe, have a list of such groups with their phone numbers in any case. We hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and your understanding. Tiffany will read the preamble.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tiffany, and I'm an alcoholic. AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Rob will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Rob. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Sean. The steps. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn all will in our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Richard will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Richard. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everyone. 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscious. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous, except when in matters affecting the other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or commitments or committees directly responsible for those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at level of press, radio, and film. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is John C.
Hello, everyone. My name is John, and I am an alcoholic. A bit nervous. You know, I'm supposed to be a billboard for God in AA, so just imagine me with a big neon sign saying, attraction, attraction, or something, I don't know. But, you know, how do I know I'm an alcoholic? You know, Bill's story is a good way to find out if you're an alcoholic. For me, it was, anyway. One of the things I identified with is the mind and body went on for 2 more years. I don't know if most of you guys read this book, I think. So you probably got to the point where his body endured 2 more years. He was already at a very low bottom, and he continued to drink for 2 more years before he actually got approached by Ebby. And for me, that was a big identifying point. I started to drink again in 1991 after 6 years of not drinking. I had a sponsor. I was in a home group. I helped other guys. I don't know what I was helping them do, but I was considered their sponsor. I was telling them all about their sex lives and various other things, what they should do with their children, finances. I was winging it pretty good, I thought. I was taught that you shut up, don't drink, go to meetings, and then when the appropriate time came, you told other people to shut up, don't drink, and go to meetings. And so I just followed suit. But then I made up some of my own stuff along the way. You hear some wonderful things in AA that you could utilize as slogans and phrases. They're not out of the big book, but they sound really cool. Such as, all you got to do perfect is step one. Well, again, let's go back to Bill's story. Let's go to my story. I did step one. I was sober for 6 years. And it was all on step one. And I got drunk again. And so did Bill. He did step one, and he got drunk again. And step one doesn't really do anything but give you step one. That's all it really does. Going to meetings does have some benefits, like people talk to you. That's nice. If you go to a good home group like this one, they got really great coffee and cookies. Sometimes pretty ladies feel sorry for you and they say hi to you. Or maybe even you'll get a hug once in a while. And I certainly got my fair share, and some of the women here have been incredible to me. I came in like 287 pounds. One of my teeth were missing. I probably hadn't been touched by another human in, I don't know, 6 or 7 years. Not that I didn't want to be, but I wasn't. You know you're in trouble when you're, like, living in Baltimore, and you're living in a crack house, and the crack people that are doing crack are, like, pointing you out and laughing at you because you're sitting in the corner with a bottle of vodka, spending $100 a night to stay in a crack house so you can drink your vodka in a safe place. Baltimore, by the way, is not a very safe place. Just if you plan on going there, just go to the Inner Harbor. Don't go west or south or east or anywhere, basically. I spent like 2 years there, and there's another part of being drunk and bottoming out. insane seemed like a really wonderful idea. You know, like, that was like my hope, that somebody would lock me up. And, you know, cops didn't really want to take me to jail when they wanted to take me to insane asylums, you know, flight decks, they call them, or whatever they call them today. I don't know. I know I've been in my fair share of them. And, in fact, I fell in love in one of them. I was in living in Delaware, and this poor lady, she didn't drive, but she thought I was insane. And the only reason why I took the drive with her nephew and her up to New York to an insane asylum, which is in Pomona, was because they fed me, I think, 3 bottles of vodka, and they were quarts. They weren't liters. I don't like liters. I like quarts. There's more in a quart, by the way. Anyway, I got there in and out of blackouts and stuff, and I remember coming out of a blackout, and they were trying to take, like, the last corner of my vodka, and I didn't want to give it to them. And so it was a big struggle. And but they let me in, and so I took off all my clothes and got up on the dining room table. There's, a community room, and this really very attractive 85-year-old lady who thought I was rather handsome, and I was dancing. And so I came out of this blackout dancing on a table with this admiring woman. And so we fell in love. But they put me in a padded room, so we didn't get to continue that relationship. Anyway, that, you know, the reality of my story is that I've been, you know, like places I shouldn't be, and I've hurt people I should not have hurt. Mother, sisters, brothers, just, you know, countless human beings, just about everybody I've ever came in contact with. I'm not really a nice guy as an active alcoholic. Sometimes I'm not a nice guy as a recovering alcoholic. I tried to be the best I can be. And, you know, I met James a couple of days into the program, maybe 4 or 5 days into the program at Bagels and Big Book, where I met Ava. And it's been a godsend, literally. He brought me to this group, told me what I had to do. I was desperate. I didn't know what the hell else to do, excuse me. And so I did what I was told. And it's so funny, you know, this is another reason why I know I'm an alcoholic, is that, you know, I'm desperate, so I do what I'm told. It's all working. Things are going good, you know. The belt size is coming down, you know. Now I'm not in shorts. I got long pants, and I'm getting clothes. And I even bought myself a used suit and tailored it and got to speak here. And then all of a sudden, I don't trust him no more. I don't trust my sponsor's opinions anymore. I don't think I'll do that, you know. That's not going to work for me. I got a lot of brains, you know, cells and stuff, and they try to work, I don't know, on their own, and that's a scary thought. But James has really, really been an amazing human being to me, and I know, you know, I'll give you a highlight of my sobriety. I was sitting in row 9, and James, I think, just met Katie, and Katie asked, Katie's my sober sister, and he walked over to Katie and pointed me out and said, "You could talk to this guy. He's a safe guy." No, that's huge. I'm a safe guy. You know something? I held on to that for a couple of months, knowing that my sponsor thought I was a safe human being for a woman to talk to and know that I wouldn't have bad motives. That's huge, you know? If you come from the world I come from and your sponsor says something like that to you, hold on to it, you know? There's a lot of gems. Stacy said, we go through things with dignity and grace. Hard times, I'm not here to show you hard times. I'm here to tell you that this program works. If you follow the suggestions out of the big book, well, suggestions, they're not suggestions. Let's not kid ourselves. They're directions. And they demand that you do it. And when I do it, it all works. And why don't I do it? Because I don't want it to work. You know, it's that simple. I like misery. I like pain. I like suffering, you know. And if I didn't have James to tell me who I am, what I am, you know, he sees the truth. That's what a sponsor does, you know. I believe lies about myself and about the world about me. He sees the truth. He explains the truth to me. And then he gives me directions out of the big book on how to apply what he sees and how to change it. You know, that's a hard job, you know. And the last thing I'm going to do, because I know I've got a short time, is that if you want to make him very happy, and James is worth happiness, you should make him very happy, is I need someone to work with. And I'll be honest with you. If you need a sponsor, I would give you, like, the shirt off my back, because I tell you, basically, that's what he's done for me, you know. This program absolutely works, and it works because this group has strong sponsorship, and we follow guidelines that are impeccable, and, you know, they just absolutely are incredible. So, what else? Let's see. Okay, I'll give you another thing. I meet a lovely lady in my life, and then I start complaining. Alcoholism, you know? I get the best of everything in my life, and then I complain about it, or I want more. And it's pretty sick, you know, it's scary, actually. And, you know, there are amazing, amazing human beings here that I get to look ahead at, you know, like, this is going to be my life if I continue this path, you know. And then there's a lot of guys behind me that I get to watch them grow. And if you don't think that's a miracle, stick around for a while and you'll see it. You'll feel it, you'll taste it, you'll touch it. You'll just, it's amazing. I'm looking at faces that I've watched come in here and just do incredible things. And I've watched people stay here that just show me the path. And it's a God-given program, and this program works. Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Robin S.
Oh God. Hi, I'm Robin, and I'm an alcoholic. And this is very exciting. no, seriously, I like lost a week of my life since I knew I had to do this last week. But Stacy, you know, constantly reminds me that my God is bigger than my problems, and fear is just another problem. And I'm grateful to be here because anything that moves me out of my comfort zone is a better idea than what I have for me in terms of what's going to help me recover. Welcome to, my sobriety date is November 26, 1990. This is my home group and my sponsor is Stacy. And I am living, happily in steps 10, 11, and 12. If you're new to AA or if you're new to this meeting, welcome. And if you're uncomfortable here or you find it intimidating, I did too. I came here in my 15th year and I found it really intimidating. And, you know, when I first started coming to meetings 16 years ago, I wasn't one of those people who walked in and was like, oh, I'm home. You know, I resented when people said that. I was awkward. I was anxious. And I was really uncomfortable, and I stayed anyway, and it got better. And, you know, I have to say that everything good I have in my life is from this program, and the people who are dearest to me are from these rooms. A little bit about how I got here. I grew up not too far from here, about 20-some-odd blocks north of here, in a family as an only child where I knew that I was loved. My parents, however, were, you know, I don't know, not very well. There was a lot of untreated mental illness and untreated alcoholism and other addictions. And, you know, I came of age in the 70s, and people just parented really differently then than they do now. It was a much more permissive atmosphere. So all of this to say that alcohol was very, very accessible to me, other things as well. You know, at 15, I smoked cigarettes in front of my parents. I got drunk in front of my parents. I later did other things with my parents. And if I wasn't doing it with them, I never, ever had to hide it. I believe that I, you know, was an alcoholic from the get-go, waiting for a drink, both in how alcohol, as it's stated in the doctor's opinion, affects me. Apparently, when I was 2 years old, I was at some family function, and my cousins who were babysitting me, who were teenagers, thought it would be really funny to keep sticking their fingers in the scotch and putting it in my mouth, and I think they thought I would fall asleep. And, you know, the story goes that at 2 a.m, I was running around the house like a lunatic. And, you know, I do believe that when I put alcohol in my body, I have a physical allergy that's then followed by, you know, a mental obsession. And, you know, and my childhood was characterized by just self-centered fear and a lot of pride. So I started drinking at 15. It talks about in the big book that this disease may progress quicker in women, or that you can go from being a potential alcoholic to the real thing really quickly. And I think that's what happened to me. I started drinking at 15, and by 16 I was a daily binge drinker. I pretty much drank to obliteration. You know, I wasn't somebody who tried to control my drinking. I never went out for a couple of drinks or a few drinks, or, you know, the idea that there would be any limit to my drinks. you know, there was never enough. I never switched to beer. I never switched to wine. You know, sometimes I tried to lay off of tequila because that was usually bad. But, you know, but it was just about, I had a real need to check out that I think just I came hardwired with. And, you know, my drinking is fairly unremarkable. I started drinking. It was sort of what defined my life for 10 years. I said I was an alcoholic when I was 16. I didn't particularly think there was anything wrong with that. And I didn't really see that any of the things that were bad in my life were a result of that. And I was really proud of my drinking because it was the one thing, it was the only thing that I thought I did well. I had a, like a freakishly high tolerance. And, you know, I could drink like any girl under the table and most guys. And, you know, and I was entertaining. And when I got drunk, at least up to the first like 8 cocktails, I was very charming and I was very lucid. And people liked to party with me. And, you know, it just kind of became my livelihood. I had a lot of drinking paraphernalia. I had hats and gloves and a monogram flask and whatever. It was, you know, it was like, I am Robin and I'm an alcoholic. That was what I was. And, you know, in the end, it just, you know, 2 things happened. It stopped working. My last drink was a 5-day round-the-clock drink, and the last 2 days I could not get drunk. It was like I had drank myself straight. And, you know, and this was really alarming because this was seriously the thing I depended on to get me through my life. The other thing was that I looked really bad, and vanity is a big part of what got me sober. I mean, I looked like I was 90. I was hanging out in bars, talking to guys. The summer before I got sober, I was like 24, and people thought I was in my late 30s. And so, you know, through sort of a convergence of circumstances and a little bit of a spiritual experience, I got here. And, you know, when I got here, it was actually in this room that I heard somebody say that when they came here, they thought that their problem was alcohol, so their solution was not drinking. And that just resonated for me so much. When I got here, I finally got the first step. I finally got that I was powerless over alcohol. I never thought that before. I thought that it was a choice. I thought that drinking every day and drinking to the point of passing out or throwing up was a choice. You know, like when psychiatrists would say to me, can you stop drinking for a day? I would be like, well, yeah, I can, but I'm not gonna. Like, why, you know, like, why would I do that? This is what makes me happy. And so when I got here, I got that I was powerless, and I got that the unmanageability in my life was really a result of my drinking. And, you know, the thing is, I wasn't very willing and I wasn't very open when I got here. And the desire to drink, the obsession to drink lifted for better or for worse early on, like in the first month. And when I say for worse, I was able to stay here and not drink and not have to work very hard for it. And so as a result of that, I didn't. I was willing to do about 3 things when I got here. I was willing to not drink. I was willing to go to meetings, which I pretty much did every day. And I was willing to fellowship because, you know, it's fun. And it was good to be around other people who weren't drinking. And the fellowship is great, but it's not the program. And I did think it was the program. So I stayed sober for a really long time on the first step and the fellowship. I had a sponsor and, you know, I called her maybe twice a week. I didn't take suggestions. I did the steps, but I never really got the second step. So, you know, I learned much later on that the steps are numbered and in order for a reason. And if you don't really get the second step, like, I'm not sure what was going on in my 4th and my 5th and my 6th and my 7th, because I didn't have God in my life at all. You know, God was an idea that later I, you know, read about and analyzed and talked a lot about, but the idea that God would have anything to do with me, the idea that I would not impose my will on any situation to get my way was just like, it wasn't even a thought. I had no idea what you guys were talking about. And what happened was, at 2 years, my sponsor fired me. I was having an affair with a man who was engaged to be married to, not me. And, you know, and she said, it's not so much what you're doing that's concerning to me, but the fact that you don't see anything wrong with what you're doing. And, you know, she was right. It was about him, and he's the bad one, and whatever. Why I wanted to be with him is, you know, another story for another fellowship. But, you know, I hadn't changed any of my behaviors. I was doing exactly what I had always done at 2 years of sobriety or abstinence. And I ended up married to this guy, and I spent 10 years with him. And this isn't about him, except to say that instead of working a program of recovery, I worked a marriage. And, you know, the more that didn't work, the harder I worked it, and the harder I looked for other things to treat my untreated alcoholism. And for people who are new and don't know what that is, you can be in these rooms and not drinking and still be suffering from untreated alcoholism. My friend Amanda was the first person to point that out to me. You know, I know this is AA, but I used food and I used money and I used getting a nicer apartment and getting a master's degree and having a baby. And when none of those things worked, I wanted a bigger apartment and another baby. And I kind of started to unravel. And when I started to lose some of the things that I had in my life, I really started to unravel. And at this point, I had stopped going to meetings. You know, if you asked me, I would tell you I was going to meetings. In my head, I was going to meetings. I just wasn't coming here. And I was having like a bit of a meltdown, and this voice came, and it was not from me because my idea was not a spiritual one, and it was like, why don't you go back to AA? And I was so desperate that I did, and I was so desperate that I listened to what you guys had to say, and like, I got it. And what I noticed was that there were people around me who, like, life was happening to them too, but they seemed to be okay with it. And the difference seemed to be that they felt that they were being taken care of by a higher power. And so I started praying for faith. And that is, to me, the moment when everything in my life changed. It talks about in We Agnostics, just... I folded down the page because I knew I wouldn't remember it. But basically that just like God doesn't make it too hard for us if we seek him earnestly just a little bit. And that was my experience because I didn't know, you know, who or what I was praying to. And I started to get better. And then I had a lot of losses in a very concentrated time. Pretty much everything in my life that I felt kept me anchored here went. In a span of about 2 years, I lost my parents and my marriage and my nice apartment and my childhood home and my doggy who was like my baby. And I got through it and I showed up. And what I learned from that was that not only did I not have to drink over any of this stuff, but I could actually show up and do what I needed to do and do it with a little bit of grace, which was not always easy. You know, I would call my friend Amanda on the phone and say, oh, and you're not going to believe what he did when I was going through my divorce. And she would listen. And then she'd say, okay, and this is how we're going to take the high road. And I really didn't want to take the high road, but this is when I really started to grow up. And, you know, I just want to say that in the last year, I made this my home group. I kind of hit a bottom. I don't want to say I hit a bottom with my program. I wasn't getting enough of what I needed. I knew about this meeting for a long time, and I was resistant to come because, I don't know, I'm resistant. I'm an alcoholic. And I came here, and I asked Stacy to sponsor me, and my life has changed dramatically. Nothing on the outside has changed dramatically, but the lens through which I view my life has changed dramatically. I do have a life beyond my wildest dreams. I have a beautiful child that, you know, I beat myself up over a lot about, you know, not being there enough, but he's, you know, he's a kid who has a sense of God and doing the right thing. And, anyway, that was a quick 10 minutes. Thank you for my sobriety. Bye.
Thumbs up. Our main speaker tonight is Jim.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Jim, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. My home group is the Just for Today group in Montrose, Colorado. I'm 64 and three-quarter miles from the Utah border, and the snow is up to about here. My sobriety date is September 21st, 1981. I want to say congratulations to all of you who are counting days. I was once there. It's a beautiful journey you're started out on. Stick with it. Very beautiful journey. I don't overemphasize time because recovery has a lot of aspects. You can get, they told me when I came in, you can get weller than well. And some of us have to struggle to get there. But I remember when I first walked into the group in a little town in Tennessee over in the Great Smoky Mountains, group of about 12 people, plumbers and farmers and blue-collar workers for the most part. They said, Jim, we have a wrench for every nut in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember thinking, they probably should be careful about saying that because it might insult some people, you know. I didn't consider myself a nut. I now know that I was worse off than that. They also told me some other things when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. They pointed out something in the preface that said to the big book, that's the first edition, it says, the purpose of this book is to show you specifically how we recovered. They did say the steps were suggestions. They said there are no requirements, but there's a whole bunch of dang well betters. They said, well, actually, there are three requirements. I said, oh. They said, develop no resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous. Have no business relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous. And develop no relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me the reason for those things was if you had a resentment, you might decide you didn't want to go to a certain meeting. And it's hard, even in a city like New York or London, to find meetings sometimes where the person you have a resentment against doesn't show up. So I found those to be three good principles to live by. If you can, you can probably tell by now from the fact that I speak English without an accent that I'm from down south. In Colorado, they call me New York Jim, and in New York, they call me Southern Jim. Sevierville, Tennessee is Dolly Parton's hometown, for those of you who like country music. I like country music. My favorite country music song is I'm Always on My Mind. It's going to be a big hit, I think. You know, I was born in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, up at about the 3,000 foot level. John Boy Walton country, to those of you of a certain age. 23 miles from Mount Airy, North Carolina, which is the home of Mayberry, to those of you who even more certain age, I used to watch Andy Griffith. My dad was a farmer, a sawmill worker and a furniture plant worker. My mother worked in a textile mill back in the days when women's hose still had seams up the back. And I took my first drink and got in trouble with my first drink when I was in the seventh grade. I got a paddling. But the first time I remember getting really high was when I was 15 years old. My first cousin and I found 2 quarts of moonshine liquor in mason jars in a neighbor's barn. And we drank a whole bunch of this stuff. And it was just this awesome, awesome, awesome experience. My brain said to me, wow, this is wonderful stuff. This must be how other people feel all the time. We had a footbridge across the creek, a foot log you walked across the creek. And I didn't have to use it that day. I walked across the water. My shoes and pants were still wet the next morning, but I'm still convinced I walked across the top of that water, you know. I now know that that was what they call a virginal high, and I set out from that day to recapture that high. And when I quit drinking at age 35, I still had never managed to capture a high as good as that one. I became a fairly regular drinker in high school. I went to a college that did not allow drinking, so I made a vow in August of the year I was entered college that I was not going to drink. And I made it till October. And I drank my roommate's Listerine. Well, actually, it was Cepacol. Listerine is better. If you drink Cepacol, bubbles keep coming out of your mouth for hours. Listerine's far better. And then from then on, I became, sort of the college drunk. I was a guy they always had to carry back to the dorms. And my sophomore year in college, one of my drinking friends, whose father was an alcoholic, told me that there was a book in the library I should check out. So I went to the library and got the first edition of the big book. This is 1966. I read the whole thing, all the way through. 164 pages plus the stories. Good book. I enjoyed it. I had 3 objections to the program they outlined. I didn't like the idea of meetings, didn't like the idea of God, and didn't like the idea of abstinence. And I proceeded to stay drunk for 16 more years. When I graduated from college, I had a goal in mind. I was going to become a sophisticated drinker. I moved to Washington, D.C., and I was working across the street from Connecticut at R Street. And there used to be a bar there called the Golden Parrot. And At 5 o'clock every night, they started a happy hour, and they had triple martinis at happy hour. So I would take one of my co-workers that I was dating over there and do the triple martinis. And one night she said, Jim, you know, when you drink, you have a personality change. And my brain said, what a nice compliment. You know, if you've been around alcoholics and their families for a while, you know what happened next. She married me, and we lived very unhappily for the next 11 years. You know? And my drinking progressed like all alcoholics' drinking does. And we were living in the Great Smokies, and I had achieved my objective of becoming a sophisticated drinker. I was, at the end, I was drinking in a 6x12 chicken house with 2 feet of manure on the floor. And my drinking companions were 6 Rhode Island Reds, 1 white Leghorn rooster, and a Dominicker sitting hen. And the reason I enjoyed drinking with the chickens was they never complained about my drinking. You know? Everybody else did, you know. And, you know, I quit drinking for lots of reasons, but, you know, all the things that the big book had talked about happened to alcoholics eventually happened to me. You know, I got a DWI, I got a jail sentence, I lost lots of things. And after, in 1979, after I got my last jail sentence, I made a decision. I said, the devil with Alcoholics Anonymous and this one day at a time stuff, you know, I tried sobering up. Doing it, you know, the first day is not good, you know. And so I decided I'm going to quit forever. I summoned up incredible amounts of willpower, and I quit forever. Forever lasted 27 days, 8 hours, and 10 minutes. And the reason I took that drink was because anybody who stays sober that long deserved a drink. You know? It's, I was constitutionally incapable of drinking and not driving. You know? I get up in the mornings and I say, I'm not going to drink today. If I do drink, I'm not going to drive. If I drive, I'm not going to black out. If I black out, I'm not going to drive on the wrong side of the Interstate 81. Those things never happened, you know, every single time. In the doctor's opinion in the big book, Dr. Silkworth says, alcoholics are people who make 1,000 resolutions and never a decision. And I made those thousands of resolutions, but I thought I made decisions, but I didn't make a decision. I'll tell you about what a miracle it is that I'm alive. I was analyzing why I was an alcoholic, and I was driving by the Sevier County Airport one day, and I said, Jim, you're an alcoholic because so many people are putting pressure on you, and you don't have time to relax. And I said, why don't you get yourself a pilot's license? No fool would ever drink and fly. I was drunk on my federal flight exam, and I passed. I went on to get advanced licenses. And one time this woman from New York called me. I have a background in being a reporter, and she wanted to tour Harlan County, Kentucky, where they were having a coal miners' strike, and it's called Bloody Harlan. It's got an incredible history. And I said, well, great, I'll fly you up there from Knoxville. So I got up that morning, and I decided, well, maybe one drink could make everything better, and went down to the airport, cranked up the plane, and ran it off the runway, and bent the prop, and did some other damage, and everybody come running out, of course, and they said, what happened, Jim? I said, the brakes grabbed, and they took the plane back to the hangar. The mechanic looked at it, and he came back out, and he said, Jim, it's a very good thing that an experienced pilot like you is flying this thing, because it has the wrong brake pads on it. And I put new pads on it. We've changed the prop. And I climbed in, took off, got to Knoxville, went in the bar there, had a few more drinks. This woman arrived, and we took off for Harlan County, Kentucky, which would be about 10 degrees northeast. And I blacked out. And I came to, I heard somebody shouting on the radio, "Pilot, please state your intentions." I said, "I intend to land." I didn't have a clue where I was. Turned out I was over Woodrum Field in Roanoke, Virginia. And, so I landed there. This poor woman, in the meantime, is having to... I don't know what she felt. I landed, put her on a Piedmont flight back to New York, went back to the bar, got me a few more drinks, headed back to Tennessee, and I blacked out again. And when I come out of the blackout, I'm taxiing down this runway. And I don't know where I am, you know. It's not considered good form to land at an airport and then go in and ask where you are, you know. It's but that's only one of many times like that. But, most important thing that's ever happened in my life is I made a decision to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I have had a great job. I just retired from it last month. I have a beautiful wife. I have a beautiful home. But Alcoholics Anonymous comes first in my life because if I didn't have AA, none of those other things would be possible. My AA group is, a loving group. If you came back in and said, I had a slip, they didn't say, thanks for coming back. That's what alcoholics do. We love you. They said, which chapter exactly in the big book was you reading when you picked up that drink? And I made a resolve. I did not want to be that poor guy, you know. I remember the first words my sponsor that I can remember, he said to me, he said, "Jim, what you need to do is lower your expectations and increase your acceptance." This was 1981. There was still an evil empire. And my brain said to me, "My God, this man's a communist, you know." John Wayne did not fight all those wars so Americans could lower their expectations, you know. One night he said to me, he said, "Jim, you're a college man, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Can you still diagram a sentence?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I think I can, George." And he said, "Well, look at them steps on the wall." He said, "Are all of them sentences?" And I looked at him a while, and I said, "No, George, they're not all complete sentences." He said, "You notice anything else?" I looked at one, and I said, "Yes, George." And he said, "What'd you notice?" And I said, "They all got a verb in them, George." He said, "That's an action word, right?" I said, "I get your point, George, you know." My group is very attractive to me. I was not allowed in bars in three counties in Tennessee. They told me one night, they said, "Jim, we think we like you. And we're going to let you make the coffee." And I was so dadbling pleased, you know, nobody asked me to do anything in so long, you know. I felt like I belonged there. And they said, "Your job is to haul Blaine to meetings every night." Blaine was a stonemason. He'd wrecked five cars trying to get his out of a parking lot. And the state of Tennessee had taken his license for 10 years. And so for every single day I showed up, I picked up Blaine and we headed to meeting somewhere. And I remember telling my wife, I said, I don't have to go to these meetings every day, but I'm worried Blaine will get drunk. And sure enough, Blaine got drunk. But I had one whole year sober. Somewhere along the line, I heard somebody say, you ought to always have yourself every single day forward obligated in Alcoholics Anonymous, just in case you couldn't remember why you don't drink. And I heard him say that July 4th weekend, 1985, they were going to have the 50th anniversary International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in Montreal, Canada. I said, I'm going to go to that. So in April of 1985, I sent a notice. I'd like to stay at the Bonaventure Hilton, which was the headquarters hotel. And this, you know, General Services sent me a notice saying, hotels have been full for months. And but we do have your reservation. So I flew to Montreal, got me a car, and I started driving. And I drove, and I drove, and I drove, and I drove some more. I'm starting to see signs that say, State of Vermont, X number of kilometers. And finally, after dark, I pull into this little place on the side of a lake. It's a motel, restaurant, and bar all combined. And the registration desk was at the bar. And I walked in, and I said, hi, I have a reservation. And they said, the guy said, mister, we don't take reservations. I said, oh, God. He said, what brings you to town? And I said, I'm at a convention in Montreal. He said, why aren't you in Montreal? I said, there's 50,000 people at this thing. There ain't no rooms in Montreal. He said, what convention is that? And I said, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, wait here. And he was gone a while, and I could hear him talking on the phone. And he came back out, and he said, okay, here's the deal. He said, tonight our daughter will sleep with me and my wife, and you can have her bed. Your meals tonight and breakfast tomorrow are free. And I've got you a room at a Holiday Inn in downtown Montreal for the duration of the convention. I said, a friend of mine is a manager there, and he always keeps one room available. I said, what's going on? He said, Alcoholics Anonymous saved my brother's life, and I always wanted to say thank you to you guys. One of those coincidences that convinces you you're into something a little more than a social organization, you know. I moved to Washington, D.C. in 1983. And I was on the 24-hour call list, December, Christmas Eve, 1985. I got a call from the desk in Alexandria, and they said, we've had a call from parents of a guy there in Alabama. He's over next to you there, and they're afraid he's drinking himself to death. And I said, we take those calls. The guy called himself. He said, no. I said, well, I don't think we take those calls, do we? And the desk guy said, no, I guess we don't. I said, well, give me his number anyway. So I'm sitting home Christmas Eve, and something told me I should go over there. So I called one of my sponsees, and we went over and knocked on the door, and we said, we're from Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a pause, and all of a sudden, liquor bottles started hitting the door. He said, I don't want anything to do with y'all. Get out of here. So Chuck and I said, yeah, we didn't do this right, you know. We didn't go over the book on that one. And I'm sitting at home Christmas Day, and something tells me I should go back over there. So I go over there, and I knock on the door, and the guy answers. And there stands a guy I knew from Chattanooga, Tennessee. Every Christmas since 1985, I've had a call. Jim, this is Hank. I'm sober X number of years. I want to thank you for showing up that day. It's my best Christmas present every year. About 10 years ago, Helen told me that she would be the program chair someday of the Atlantic Group. And she was going to invite me here to speak, and I had to tell my Canada story. So another promise has been fulfilled. My group told me that their reading of the big book and their own experience told them that the back of an alcoholic's brain always wanted to get high again, and they thought the reason that the steps and the fellowship worked was it kept the front part of your brain constantly reminded of what this disease is all about. They referred to that one simple declarative sentence in the big book that says, "We are not cured of alcoholism, period." And I've been watching, time I've been in, I've seen people with as much as 33 years go back out, and they had sponsors, they were activists, and so anybody can get sober. Staying sober is a challenge. A few months ago, I was telling somebody in the medical community in my hometown that I was an Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy said, "Well, it's kind of a cult, isn't it?" I said, "Well, doctor, I don't know about that, but I said, you know, I'd rather be in a cult than be in a casket." And that's where I would be, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And I go to 7 or 8 meetings a week. I sponsor several guys and gals. I have a woman sponsee in Nags Head, North Carolina. She's sober 24 years. And last September, she sent me an email. We joke with each other on emails a lot. And she said, "Wow, 25 years, that must be awesome." And I sent her an email back. I said, "Yeah, and the best part of it is after 25 years, it's no longer a 13th step and it's service work." And she sent me a note back saying, "You really have found a new reality, haven't you?" And the grapevine had a definition of 13th step and a few years back. It said, "My life is unmanageable, and I'd like to share it with you." When Bill wrote the letter in the 1950s to thank Dr. Jung for his contribution to Alcoholics, to the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Jung wrote back some phrases in Latin, and but he said basically, it's hanging on a wall up at Stepping Stones, but Dr. Jung said, "It's no accident that human beings call alcohol spirits." And he said, "The solution is spirituality versus spirits." I don't think it takes a whole lot. I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church, and I doubt if there are very many Southern Baptists in the audience here. I don't mean to be critical of religion, but my interpretation of Southern Baptist religion was, if you're really, really lucky, your life would be a veil of tears and you'd die and go to heaven. And it's a terrible burden to live under, you know. I've studied a lot of theology, and I read a lot of, I just finished The God Delusion, and I've read both of Scott Harris's books, and I'm current on thinking about religion and spirituality and such things. And I bottom line it. There is a doctrine out there that says God is love. I challenge anybody to tell me that they found more love in any organization in the world than you'll find in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just that simple. Forget all the arguments. Forget all the, you know, God either is or he isn't, you know. Just deal with that part. It's the only organization I've ever been a member of where people really, really, really go out of their way to help you out. Carry the message to some other sufferer. I was reading, one of the nice things about retirement is I'm catching up on my reading. I was reading this book the other day and it said, every person, however ill-informed, is a disciple of some long-dead philosopher. I thought, my goodness, you know, I studied philosophy in college. I wonder who I'm a disciple of. And I thought about it for a while, and I come to the conclusion I'm a disciple of that great American philosopher, Mae West. Mae said, too much of a good thing is wonderful. She said, of all the people I know in the world, I love myself most. And she said, I was once Snow White, but I drifted. I was never Snow White, but I drifted. But, you know, I came into this organization and I had no way of life. I had no philosophy to believe in. I had no guidelines. I had no friends that were I could communicate with, and I was in denial about lots of things. And, you know, a lot of miracles have happened in my life, and I've seen so many miracles in the rooms that, you know, I have to believe there's a loving God that looks after all of us. I've discovered some other things about a way of life, though. I'm told there's a newcomers group somewhere has a sign on the wall that says, welcome, the war is over, you lost. And on the other wall it has a sign that says, surrender does not mean defeat. Surrender means moving over to the winning side. And that's what I've discovered, that there's a lot of power in powerlessness. There's a lot of victory in surrender. And I have discovered that those first 100 who talked about being rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence knew what they were talking about. It's a delight to be with you, and thank you very much. Thanks, Alan.